You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Good morning, good morning. Morning. Discovering God. I used to work with someone named Jean Cantrell, and she would frequently say to people, "Stop acting the fool." And I thought this sort of fit our passage today. For two chapters now, there's been a contrast between foolishness and wisdom. And when Paul talks about wisdom, frequently it's in air quotes because he doesn't think their wisdom is actually all that wise. And he realizes that they think what he thinks is wise is foolish because this culture values wisdom quite a bit. And they have a long history of focusing on wisdom. So let's go ahead and get started. Fear God, stop acting the fool. Corinthian culture valued wisdom. And we've actually benefited from it because if you take a logic class, a lot of what's in a logic class came from this culture. Learning how to assess and evaluate whether something was true or false, deductive reasoning, learning how to observe and carefully evaluate your observations, inductive reasoning. A lot of this started hundreds of years ago in the Greek culture. And Paul says as much in the first chapter of 1 Corinthians when he says, the Greeks seek wisdom. It's true. They also valued the art of persuasion or rhetoric. Now, rhetoric sometimes has a negative tone because you can use rhetoric to persuade people of false things, right? But rhetoric is really a skill, it's a skill that the Greeks had highly developed so that they were able to be persuasive. And I want you to notice that Corinthian culture, which values a certain kind of wisdom, that is wisdom of logic, observation and logic, and rhetoric are both very focused on people and their skillfulness. Do you see that? And this is going to be why they find Christianity so foolish, because it's not focused on human skill. It's not focused on human abilities to persuade. It's focused on something they think is dumb. This wisdom is naturalistic. It's not religious. 300 years before this time, in the time of this writing, I'll get into this in a minute, but this wisdom would not and could not explain God. This is why Paul thinks it's not wisdom. Now, there are certain things that wisdom can get you. In Paul's letter to the Roman church, he says that when you look into nature, if you look at it properly, you realize this has been created. It didn't just happen. And so in evaluating nature, you can at least get to the point that there is a creator God. And frankly, even the Greeks believed there were gods because they could see nature. And Paul also says in the second chapter of Romans that people can look within themselves and realize, I'm not all that. I make a lot of mistakes and blunders. I've got moral problems. If a powerful God exists, it could be I'm in danger, right? That much could be gained through observation and wisdom, internal observation, external observation. But this wisdom could not and would not explain God. Would not because it was a naturalistic religion. They weren't interested in the spiritual realms. They're interested in the natural realms. So it would not explain such things. And it could not explain such things. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 21, "For since the world did not know God through wisdom," I'm going to air quote that. "Since the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe." Now, the folly of what they preach is not gained by wisdom. It's gained by revelation. That is, God has to reveal certain things. That is foolish from their perspective. And so Paul said God revealed what they did not know. And just before I go on, I should point out that through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe, this revelation that Paul said he got is this. Sometimes I'll run into people who they're not spiritually interested. They're sort of like, you know, if you try to talk about what you believe, because they don't want to be persuaded. But frequently I'll just say to a friend who's sort of like super resistant to being persuaded, I'll just say, I'm not actually trying to persuade you, but you at least need to understand what it is Christians believe. So if you say no, you know what you're saying no to. And maybe I'll ask, what do you think Christians believe? And they'll tell me something. It's usually something wrong. And so I'll say, would you mind if I just tell you what Christians believe, and then I'll leave it there, and you can just decide what to do with that or not. And this is what I'll typically say. God has revealed something that we have a problem with him that we cannot solve. And, you know, the Bible describes it this way, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And this problem we cannot solve leads to alienation from God. And God, when he realized, he didn't just like, oh, why didn't I think of this? He knew all along this was going to be a problem. God decided that his solution was that he would deal with the problem of human moral failure by dying on a cross. And so he came, God came in the person of Jesus and died for sin. And those who turn to God and ask, will you forgive me through what Jesus did on the cross? Those are the ones who are saved. Saved from what? Saved from God's wrath. There's no good news without bad news. And the bad news is either you deal with your moral failures or let Jesus deal with your moral failures. And this is the heart of what a Christian is. It's not about rituals. It's not about going to church. It's not about this, that, or the other thing. It's about, have you dealt with what Jesus did on the cross? If you have, you are someone who believes, and therefore you're someone who's saved. This is what Paul was preaching to them, and they thought this was stupid. That a God would come down and do something like this? When he tried to bring this stuff up in Athens and Mars Hill, the minute he brought this up, they're like, ah, what a seed picker, meaning someone who just gathers various thoughts together and throws them out like scattering seeds. Nothing coherent, nothing wise. So Paul claimed God revealed himself. This seemed really dumb to the Greek audience, as I've said. They were skeptical, as I said also, that God's revealed anything. 300 years before this time, Epicurus, a Greek philosopher, taught that although gods exist, they have no involvement in human affairs. He taught that people should act ethically, not because gods punish or reward them for their actions, but because due to the power of guilt in someone's own heart, amoral behavior would inevitably lead to remorse, weighing on their consciences, and as a result, they would be prevented from attaining ataraxia, which means peace and freedom from fear. Now, this stuff and variants of this have been taught for centuries now. So you can imagine when Paul shows up and says, God revealed, they're like, and God came in the flesh to pay for human sin. You know, it just seems so stupid. They were skeptical God's revealed. And also, I think there's something important too, is that if God has to reveal something, it means God is the source of the most important truths, not us. Not my wisdom, not my rhetoric, not all these things this culture valued, the skill of a person to think logically, the skill of a person to unpack the illogic of someone else, the skill of a person to persuade. It's humbling to realize you don't have what it takes to figure this out. Now, in our passage, all I'm doing is leading up this. We've been talking about wisdom for a couple of weeks now. And all I'm doing is reiterating probably what some others have said. And I just want to say, chapter 3 talks about a human impediment to becoming wise, really wise, not air quotes wise, but actually wise. An impediment to becoming wise is being controlled by the flesh. He says in chapter 3, verses 1 through 3, but brothers, I could not address you as spiritual people, but as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you were not ready for it. And even now you're not ready, for you're still of the flesh. Sarkikos, of the flesh, meaning controlled by the flesh. And it's contrasted with being controlled by the Spirit. And so someone who's controlled by the flesh, someone who's an infant in Paul's language, is foolish from a biblical point of view. What evidence does he provide that they're controlled by the flesh? They're in conflict with each other. For while there's jealousy and strife among you, are you not of the flesh and only behaving in a human way? And so he looks at their behavior. Now, this is the lens he looks at them through, and he's like, you're in conflict all the time. That means you're fleshly. That means you're foolish. That means you're not, biblically speaking, wise. They were in conflict with each other, and that's one marker. But the other thing, and it's tied to their conflict, is they pursued partisan loyalties toward leaders. For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, are you not being merely human? And so they're fighting, they're in conflict, but they're also in conflict over who is the leader, who's the best leader. And there wasn't just these leaders like Paul, Apollos, and Peter, which are mentioned in chapter 1. It's also other leaders who are actually corrupt and misleading people. Not good leaders, but it's a mixture of good and bad leaders, and everyone has their party that they're loyal to. And this is, by the way, a guess on my part, but I think they rejected the proper role of spiritual leaders, because we go back to chapter 1, and we'll see the same thing brought up in chapter 1. I appeal to you, brothers, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and the same judgment. For it's been reported to me by Chloe's people that there is quarreling among you, my brothers. What I mean is that each of you says, I follow Paul, or I follow Apollos, or I follow Cephas, the alternative name is Peter, or I follow Christ. Now, it would seem like this last one that I've made yellow, I think it's yellow, I'm colorblind, would be the way you would want to land. You would want to land on following Christ. But why did he lump it in here? I've actually heard people say this. Not because they're really following Christ, but because they refuse to follow leaders. I'm just following Jesus. And this is their way of ignoring what leaders are trying to guide them toward. And so they rejected also the proper role of leaders. Why would we do that? I'm going to stop here for a second. This is not unfamiliar to us in this fellowship. It wasn't unfamiliar to us when I first came around many, many years ago. People would say, I follow Gary. I follow Dennis. I follow Buck. I follow Leffel. And I had some of my friends say, I just follow Jesus, which meant they weren't following anyone except their own thoughts. And so it was typical back then, but I actually see it today. Partisan loyalty. I heard someone say, you know, back in the day, we used to follow the Holy Spirit. And I'm like, were you there? Yes, we were following the Spirit. Yes, we were involved in great things. And yes, we were carnal. We used to be called the flesh house because of the carnality of people in this group. Some today won't trust leaders. They won't trust current leaders. So I hope this is going to slice a little closer to the bone, because we're at a point of transition, right? Our founders, our senior elders have retired. Our new elders are stepping up. And a lot of us feel free to sit back and sort of evaluate who's worthy of following and who isn't. So why do we do this? And I think this gets into how to become wise. And I'll tell you, the title says fear God, and there's not this expression, fear God, is not in anything I'm about to unpack. So I need to stop for a second and explain what fearing God means. Fearing God means you're totally riveted on Him. You're devoted to him. When you feel in conflict with someone, you're turning to him. What has he provided? What do I need to change my mind about? Lord, right? Riveted on God. So fear of the God can range from stark raving fear, which you should have if you haven't received Christ and will one day, all the way to just being awestruck by and preoccupied with and devoted to. You know, if a great celebrity came strolling through our midst, every eye would be locked on them. If you knew who the celebrity was. I don't know any celebrities anymore. But every eye would be locked on them. Why? It's a form of the fear of whatever the celebrity is. And so they're not fearing God, and I'm going to explain in particular how it shows up here. We act the fool, I think, because we want glory from human associations. That is, I'm important because of what people think. I'm important because of who I affiliate with. This is how I matter. But Jesus says something very interesting. It's kind of odd to Jesus that he is doing everything the rabbis expected Messiah to do, and they still won't believe him. Well, it's not odd to him because he explains exactly why. I do not receive glory from people. Glory means weight, heaviness. The fear of the Lord is someone who glorifies God, gives him weight, gives him significance. I've come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, that is a self-glory person, you'll receive him. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another, but do not seek the glory that comes from the one and only God? This is the fear of the Lord. Someone who's riveted on God. How am I going to feel like I matter? I'm going to matter because he will make me matter, not because I or anyone else thinks I matter. You see how much conflict is tied up in what people think? Do you ever hear of in-group bias before? This is part of what's going on here. In-group bias is the tendency to favor one's group, like the Apollosites or the Paulites or the Cephasites or the Jesusites, right? Is to favor one's own group. All those who are for Paul, raise your hand. Okay, let's go hang out over here. And let's mock everyone else, right? That's in-group bias. It's to favor one's group over other groups. In-group bias affects our perception of and behavior toward others, giving preferential treatments to the members of our own group while excluding other groups. This is what it's like to be fleshly. You see it in politics today, don't you? Who are you? Proud of? Who do you extol? Who do you cite? Who do you quote? The people that are in the group. Who do you rail on and make fun of and mock? The people who are not in the group. Isn't this just ego? Isn't this just foolishness? Isn't this just being fleshly? It is. It is. We act the fool not only because we want glory from our human associations, but because we're disappointed in human leaders. They disappoint us. We're criticizing leaders not for moral failures, but for differences in focus and differences in abilities and differences in roles. There is a category for a leader being criticized and rebuked and even stepped down for moral failure. But these biases weren't about moral failure. They were about stuff like this. If you look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 19, here's a context for how do you deal with a leader who's morally failing. This is not what's going on. Apollos was a skilled rhetorician and teacher. Next to Apollos, Paul sounded like a hick. We know this because he brings it up not only in this letter, but in the other letter, 2 Corinthians, he talks about not using rhetoric, not using lofty speech, as he described it. He talks about how people saw him as Soren having terrible speech patterns. He was, after all, someone who spoke Hebrew, speaking Greek, so it's possibly that. It's just possibly he wasn't all that spiffy in the way he talked, at least not the way this culture regarded spiffy. We also read in 2 Corinthians that Paul didn't take pay. like other teachers did. You'd think we'd be like, well, that's cool, we get off the hook on that. But that was, in this culture, it was honored to pay someone for their work. Paul was an apostle. That is, he was someone sent by God to establish churches. He established this one. He was there for 18 months. And he was a miracle worker. But he wasn't a smooth talker. Now, those who were following Paul were like, yeah, you know, he's not like that smooth talker Apollos. He's a real power of God guy. Peter was the head of the church, according to Jesus. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, Jesus was an apostle too, but he was the chief apostle. He was the one that was put over the church. And so you could see where people were like, you know, he's the actual leader. These other people aren't the actual leaders. We're going to follow him. In order to avoid a foolish focus on people, we've got to fear God. We've got to be devoted to him. God is the one who gives us all we need, not our in-group. He gives us glory, not our in-group. He provides for us, not our in-group. If I am full of the fear of the Lord, I am looking to and I'm devoted to him as the provider of all things. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 12, we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might understand what? The things freely given to us by God. This is the perspective of someone who's not foolish, someone who's wise, is that they realize all that I have and need comes from him. All that I've needed, your hand has provided. Right, that song goes, great is your faithfulness, Lord, unto me. Right? This is the perspective of someone who fears the Lord. God gives us also our leaders. If you want to get a little nervous about your own tendency to judge others and judge leaders in particular, take a stroll through the Bible about what happens when people decide the leaders God has provided aren't good enough. God's the one who provides our fallen and flawed leaders. What then is Apollos? Our text says. What is Paul? Servants through whom you believed as the Lord assigned each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one. That is, we're both doing what? God's work. And each will receive his wages according to his labor, for we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. And I think it's an interesting reminder that you don't belong to yourselves, which is how foolish people think. Look at this. Who are these people, these leaders? They're servants. Of whom? Of God. What kind of work are they doing? They're doing work that God has assigned them. Who's the one that provides the growth? God provides the growth. No one matters except God. This is what the fear of God looks like, is you recognize he's the provider of the servants and of the growth. God's fellow workers, God's field, God's building. Part of fearing God, too, is realizing God is the one who evaluates the work. Not y'all. He evaluates the leader's work. According to the grace of God given me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation and someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care how he builds upon it. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. This is what we talked about earlier, that revelation about Jesus Christ providing a pathway to God. That's the foundation of this church, this gathering of people who believe. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw. And so we have this mixture of precious and worthless things. And this is this crazy structure called the church. this mixture of things that are super valuable and super messy. Each one's work will become manifest for the day, that is the day God evaluates, will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he'll receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he'll suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. And so what's he describing? He's describing a point, and I don't know if it's at the end of days or if it's all through the course of life here on earth or both, but God's going to evaluate everyone's work. You know, I've known some people who have were believers and they're servants of God, and when they died, I've heard people say, there's going to be a huge bonfire. And others say, there's going to be a lot of gold, silver, and precious stones left over. You know, this is the beauty of being evaluated by God, is that in the end, what's useless is gone and what's precious remains. Paul says in another letter, 2 Corinthians, we make it our aim to please him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, this bema, that seat they had in Corinth where judgments were delivered, so that each one may receive what's due for what he's done in the body, whether good or evil. In another place, in the next chapter, in fact, I don't want to steal from the next teacher, but I'll just quote it and not really go into a lot of detail. It's the Lord who judges me. See, Paul understood who the evaluator was. And frankly, if you're in a leadership position, you need to understand this too, because you'll be critiqued by human beings. Can you absorb that and realize God's the one who evaluates me and not get sucked into what people think? But anyway, therefore, don't pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Boy, this sounds like it's going to be really bad. You know, not just what I've done, but my attitude is going to be evaluated. This sucks. And then each one will receive what? What? His commendation from God. Where's the condemnation? He is looking at the heart after all. It's at the cross. Jesus paid for that. So you have, if you're a follower of God and trying to serve God, I'll just tell you this, you've got nothing to look forward to but praise. I didn't do that much. You'll be praised for that. I did a lot of stupid things. That'll burn up and you'll be praised for what remains. It is foolish to take on God's role as judge. If you have the fear of the Lord, you will not touch this judgment. You'll resist the temptation to take judgment. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It's before his own master that he stands or falls, and stand he will, for the Lord is able to make him stand. Oh, I'm full of judgments. This morning I was full of judgments. I was pacing around in my kitchen, thinking about someone who was making my work harder and who wasn't lifting a finger to help and actually was making my work workier. And I thought about this passage, judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you'll be judged. And with the measure you use, it'll be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but you don't notice the log that is in your eye? Let me get that speck for you, right? The assumption that Jesus is laying out here is you always have the log. I know I've been in a lot of conflict, and I'm thinking, okay, I've got the speck, they've got the log, but this is not the way Jesus is portraying this. We always have the log. How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when there's a log in your own eye? You hypocrite! First take the log out of your own eye, then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. And so, as I'm muttering this morning, I thought, I kept asking God, would you please help me to stop this? This is terrible. I don't want to be judgy. I don't want to be this way. I don't want to think negatively about this person. And it didn't go away, didn't go away. And then suddenly I had this thought, as I was driving here, they've got it really hard. They don't have any harder than I do. And I thought, you know, I felt like God was guiding me and saying, imagine doing what they're currently doing. I'm like, it would be hell to do what they're currently doing. Do you think it's possible that God has given you an opportunity to serve and help because they're in such a tough spot right now? Why are you not happy to bless them? Why are you walking around cursing them? Oh, I suck. I'm a hypocrite, right? But it's odd that once I realized, you know, if I step into their situation, I realize how hard they have it. My negative thoughts evaporated. God's also going to evaluate your work. We've already read this. Everyone's work will be evaluated and then each will receive their commendation. We've already read this. But in our passage, it's brought up just in the negative. Do you not know that you are God's temple and God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. Yikes. For God's temple is holy, and you are that temple. Let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks he's wise in this age, that is wise with air quotes, let him become a fool that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is folly with God. As it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. And so you're also going to be evaluated. I mean, Jesus himself said, what, in Matthew 25, that I was thirsty and you didn't give me water, and I was naked and you didn't clothe me, and I was hungry and you didn't feed me. Like, when did that ever happen? In that you didn't do it to the least of these, my brothers, you didn't do it to me. God takes personally your response to other of his people. The spiritually wise know they belong to God, and that is their focus. And when they drift away from that focus, they find their way back to it again, just like I had to do this morning. When we shift from a God focus to a human focus, we bring harm to God's people and God's work. I've seen this over and over again with the partisan bickering, putting down some leaders, following other leaders, the in-group bias that goes on amongst those who are with you, with your person you're following, it hurts God's work. That's why he warns to take care. So, he says in conclusion, if you didn't get this point, let no one boast in men. Why? Well, I guess it goes back to focus on God again, because this, all things are yours. You are rich, not impoverished. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or the present or the future, all are yours, and you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. Once you have this perspective, it really settles down a lot of foolishness. So, enjoy all the riches God brings to you. This is my week of feeling negative. I was feeling negative towards someone else this week. And I couldn't shake it. And I woke up and I kept thinking about the thing that I didn't like about them. And I thought, I don't know how to get rid of this. And so what I did was this. I even wrote it down on my phone at 2:00 in the morning. I just started thinking about God, and this is what I thought. First, I started out, God, your thoughts are higher than mine. Your love is limitless. You forgive. You give gifts undeserved. When I resist you, you pursue me persistently. When I turn away from you, you turn toward me. When I resent your convictions instead of repenting, you don't give up on me. When I focus on my frustration with others, you remind me I'm just like the ones I resent in my attitude toward you, but your response is faithful love. And then I thought, on the day I resented this person, I was reminded of God's great love, how he's blessed me through them. And so what happened? Why did I shift from this negative perspective to the positive one? I first focused on God and how good he was. And as I was doing that, I began remembering, my eyes lifted up from the current situation and remembering how much God had blessed me through the person I was cursing. Enjoy the riches God brings you. And as you focus on him and these things, you'll have less occasion to drift toward, as Gene Cantrell said, acting the fool. There's a huge difference between discernment and judgment. If we could discern this leader or that leader maybe having a problem, Lord, help us to not shift into judgment, that self-righteous posture, but help us to fast and pray for that leader. Help us to have the boldness to speak directly to them about the thing that concerns us. And I thank you that you've given us the mind of Christ. You've given us your revelation. We have a way of evaluating. This is good. This is better. This is best. But protect us from taking our sense of significance from our judgments, our evaluations. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.